1970 maybe the point of, you see, somebody was, you were talking about flunking out, and most of the people who made the biggest innovations in this field did, in fact, flunk out. Well, in fact, none of them flunked out. They all disappeared, right? I don't think at MIT I've ever heard of anyone flunking out, at least it happens. But the point is that it wasn't until 1970 that the professors could be said to know more than the students in computer science. They had a kind of artificial view, and I think this may be a real phenomenon. It certainly is why so many of these discoveries came from below. And the image that Jack Dennis was head of RLE is a perfectly reasonable view from the bottom. Right, because he's all the way up there at assistant professor rank. Everything anyone said brought dozens of images, like going over to Heffron's and getting the right switches to play space.
Eli's.
So Eli's is still there, but it's no use anymore, because it only sells parts from computers. And the point, there was a great junkyard which had every possible kind of surplus, but it had surplus you could use, because if you're doing anything with computers, you obviously don't want computer parts. One of the ironies there. Yes, there was a nice moment of banning space war, just for a little while, of course. Many years later, some town of Braintree or somewhere banned arcade games, and I remember thinking, oh, they thought of that too. Well,
with equal success.
Right. It won't work. One of the great mysteries to me of this whole period was the disappearance of the graphic display. DEC started it pretty much. I was just mentioning to McCarthy, it's really hard to believe the 704 was before the PDP-1, and I have this pretty well confused in my mind. But, well, of course, the 704 was a bigger, more powerful computer, but you couldn't program it much. And I don't think anybody's even mentioned Steve Russell's role in the programming of the first versions of Lisp. It played an immensely important role in that, but that was mostly on the other computer. I remember when we got the PDP-6 one day, when was that, about 66? When did the PDP-6 appear? 64. Just a year or so after the PDP started. Well, anyway, it turned up, and I said, well, now we've got our own real computer. How are we going to do our AI research on it? There's no Lisp. And the end of the next weekend, there was.
Well, actually, it's been going on for some time.
Nobody told me. So a great deal of the success that I'm credited with, and John and I in the AI lab, came from the fact that all this research was BP, and the same people who did these hacker exploits also did an immense amount of serious scientific work, mostly by figuring out what was going to be needed next year in AI. And so when I said, let's have a Lisp, and they said, well, it'll take at least 3 or 4 days. A few other things. Anyway, there was this decay of graphics. The PDP-1 had this thing, and you could say plot XY. The only other machine that I've been able to plot XY on is some little Casio pocket computer which has a plot XY in its BASIC, but it's almost impossible to plot XY in any real computer. And so in order to do graphics research, you have to get an awful lot of equipment set up and go to an awful lot of trouble. Later, I built one myself. I built a little computer for working with for children to be able to run logo programs. Unfortunately, it cost more than anybody thought, and schools couldn't afford it, but it had a vector plotting scheme, and that was great fun. Then shortly after that, I saw one in a little computer game named Vectrex, which I guess has bit the dust. As soon as raster displays came out, graphics went downhill and took maybe many years to recover. Oh, there are lots of other wonderful stories, but there are too many. It's getting too late.
Professor McCarthy, would you like to say a couple words here? John McCarthy.
Well, I don't have very much to add to what has already been said. I would like to compare a little bit the psychology of that time with the psychology of computer use today. Maybe I am guessing here because I don't really know too much about really either one. Consider that the PDP-1, as people said, started with a 1K memory and went up to a 4K memory and then somewhat more. And now people are talking, well, 1 megabyte is really rather small, and Harvard gave me letting me use a machine with 8 megabytes just as a terminal, and so forth. Now, I have not actually learned to write program 8,000 times as fast as I did many years ago. In fact, I probably write somewhat slower than I did memory years ago. And while people are somewhat faster, they aren't certainly 8,000 times as fast as the people many years ago. And the result is, of course, that people have to program at, so to speak, more like an executive level, where they don't really know what all these pieces that they are ordering around are. I mean, like the boss of a company who doesn't fully understand what his henchmen are doing or thinking or going, but he gives them some orders and hopes that the right thing will happen. Well, now it seems to me that a programmer is a kind of executive putting together these parts. And what is always amazing me is people are saying, well, 3 megabytes is not really enough. You need more. And of course, the answer is if they really knew what was going on and were in a position to change it, even 3 megabytes for many of these things would be plenty. Well, I had something else I was going to say, but I forgot what it was, so I think I'll stop.
Richard Greenblatt, one of the canonical hackers from that period, will say a couple things. Then I will allow time for maybe a couple questions from you.
Well, I was really a latecomer to the PDP-1 scene. I arrived as an undergraduate and never was an official user or anything, but what I did was the sign-up list went up on Friday morning, 8 o'clock, I think. And within an hour, the entire week for the following week was signed up 24 hours a day, users coming in and signing up. So then I would come along and look at the sign-up list and see who was signed up and try to figure out who was usually late for their computer time. And I would then wait around, and the appointed hour would come along, and somebody would be a few minutes late showing up for their computer time. And I would jump on the machine and play around and do my thing, and then maybe they wouldn't show up for their time at all, or maybe they would come in 15 minutes late or something. And that was computer access in those days. Later, I was involved in a number of these things that have been alluded to. I don't have too much to add to the good stories, though, that have been related about it, so I think I'll be.
Okay.
Another thing I was going to say. Importance. The SAIL system at Stanford was originally a PDP-6 and went through various versions of PDP-10 and is a KL-10 and is, of course, thoroughly obsolete, but nevertheless still working. At least the new service works and so forth. Will, if it lasts, be turned off on June 8th of next year, which will be its 25th anniversary. And I've been thinking about how it should celebrate its demise, and it should send people a message, I think. So if anyone wants to be sent the final message of the sale computer just before it's turned off, then you should communicate. But now, having sort of thought of that from an administrative point of view, it's not instantly clear to me as to where you should send this email. I'm not sure exactly. Well, my poor secretary, I'll make her do it. So if you want to be sent email when sale is turned off, send email to MPS, M as in Mary, P as in Pat, S as in Simmons, at cs.stanford.edu, and you'll get the final message of the PDP-10, provided it doesn't crash irrevocably in the meantime, because if it crashes in the meantime, it's sort of been agreed that no heroic measures will be will be undertaken. It is asked for that. It has this living will.
Okay, one more person to say a word. Ted Johnson, like the call up here. Maybe he can tell us about something about selling the machine, because as Dex, VP of sales for 20-some years, he probably had to convince people to pay this very reasonable sum for a PDP-1.
Well, I hope I don't contaminate this hacker's delight by throwing in a commercial dimension, but I think I can add a few facts here in a different perspective. As Ed Fredkin pointed out, before the PDP-1, Digital was entirely a modules company, and you're looking at the sales force at the time that the PDP-1 was invented. I was the only person in the field. We had no field, only person in sales, officially, that is. Everybody was really selling, but I was the only sales engineer. And we had no field offices. I was in Maynard. One exception to the module business is that we also sold memory testers. And even though I was the only sales person out selling modules, they took me out of the field for about 2 weeks to design the first memory tester with the logic. After talking with RCA, the company decided to build their own system. Now, I didn't really realize they were laying the groundwork for being into the computer business at all. I mean, our total focus was the module business. And I really didn't know all the cards that Ken was planning to play, although I had seen the business plan originally, and I probably should have known better. But we were really focused. Anyway, in April of 59, I happened to be in the office with Ken and Harlan Anderson when a request for a quotation came in. We opened it up. It was from the U.S. Naval Ordnance Test Station in Pasadena. And it was a request for a 36-bit machine, 5 megacycles, fit the module line perfectly. And Ken turned to me and he said, "This is just what I wanted to build. Go sell us a computer." What's a computer? Didn't really know. So after thinking about it, and talking to Ben Gurley, who joined in June, the decision was made that, well, if we're going into the computer business, the 36-bit machine is going to take a while, not only to build, but also to close the sale with the Navy. Why don't we start small and build an 18-bit machine? And, oh, by the way, we should probably build one in the middle someplace. I've never known whether that was supposed to be 24 or 27 bits, but that's the reason why there was a gap. There was a PDP-1, the PDP-2, and the PDP-3. And I believe a PDP-3 actually was built, by the way. We had a line of 10 megacycle modules, and many, many years later, I was shown that machine. It's over in Waltham someplace in a basement by some drug company.
Customer put it together.
Right.
They ordered one that declined to build it. Actually, two were ordered. AFCRL ordered one. They were delivered two PDP-1s with some explanation that that's not so the other one was a company, I think it was an architectural firm, and they really wanted it, so they said, do you have any pieces of paper with any kind of design? They took the design, bought the modules, and built a machine and made it work. So,
got that color, though. After you surplus it, and Mike Dealer programmed Goldberg and so forth. Goldberg is wonderful things on it.
Yeah. Xcope had a really interesting career at MIT. It first came to the AI lab, and then it went to RLE. It went to about four different research laboratories. Each stop about a year and a half or 2 years. It made all kinds of pretty pictures of each laboratory.
I got a great program called Wireworks. Wonderful fireworks. And that was a very good program because we never got the colors to converge. But in the case of wire, it was
well, getting, if you can't fix the hardware, fix the program.
Getting back to the commercial side. Ben Gurley joined in June and began designing and laying out the PDP-1. And we introduced a working machine in November. So there was a tremendous time-to-market issue, and from our perspective, selling modules is just a testimony to what you could really do with using our standard modules. The one competitor that we had in the first year that I recall was CDC, the 168. I have a slightly interesting story there, too. I think most of you might know that Digital and CDC started off the same month, same year, September 1957, both going off in the scientific engineering area, but totally different strategies. And I was, in my module selling, was very, it was difficult to find a customer for modules in those days. And I remember calling up CDC at one point and visiting them in Minnesota and trying to sell them on converting and using our modules to build their computer. Of course, they were much too far along. It was a silly idea, but I was naive and an eager salesperson. I did see in the side when they were building the 1604, what was the first? Yeah. And the 160A was the machine, the prototype, or the test machine that they built. And it was sort of a sideline for them to go out and try to sell this machine. I think they were the first ones to ever, however, make a deal, a OEM contract for small machines. From then on, the brass largely focused on the real selling of PDP-1s for a couple of years. And the sales force, now I was on the West Coast, continued to largely focus on selling modules. We did sell, there were 49, I believe, PDP-1 sold. 16 of those were sold to ITT, who used them for message switching communications applications. And Nick Mazarese was brought in to be the account manager for ITT. That was really the start of the computer OEM business. And of course, later on in 1965, when we went to the product line organization, Nick was put in charge of all the small computers. Well, I think that's just some added perspective. Thank you.
Just like make a comment. When DEC got started, the one ground rule they had was no software. That was for other people. You want this machine, you guys write the software. And about selling the computers, I remember that one day we had a PDP-1 at BBN, and Harlan Anderson, who was sort of like a partner with Ken Olson as running the company, called me and said, would I go with him on a sales call for a PDP-1? And I said, sure. So we went off to Ohio State University and talked up the PDP-1, and it was clear that they weren't going to give an order right then and there. As we were coming back on the plane, Harlan Anderson grumbled to me and said, that's the last time we'll ever do that. And I said, that's the last time you'll ever do what? He says, call on someone to try and sell them a computer. If someone wants one of these machines, they got to come here and buy it. And that's Before I throw it open for some questions, I actually have a question. There was one story which I determined at least to be at least partially apocryphal. It concerned a little wire that some of the hackers maybe here hooked up between the TX0 and the PDP-1 and played wanted to play a prank on the professors. The way the story usually goes is the professors are Professors Minsky and McCarthy to say, we have hooked up this computer, rigged the computer, given it software to play chess. And, you know, one was in one room, the other was in the other room, and they were actually playing against each other, thinking they were playing against the computer, until one of them, I think as the story goes, McCarthy, noticed that the moves were being really put on one letter at a time as a person would type it, and walked in the other room and discovered it. And I think I had eliminated Marvin Minsky from the story maybe when I asked him about it.
I think he heard
it. No, Shannon has the story.
John, you see, any name in computing winds up in one of those rooms. But, Professor Carly, do you remember that at all?
If you ask anybody,
the part about me is correct.
Okay, that's the way I had it in the book. So,
I conjectured that I was playing against some human, but it just seems to me I wasn't actually told against whom I was playing. So I just assumed that it was one of the hackers. Is that true or not?
Well, I attributed the story to Samson, the way he told it after I eliminated Minsky. That he insisted the idea was that you're playing against the computer here, and not another human, but that's
Yes, it was certainly billed that way.
Okay. All right. So
you were suspicious.
I once was fooling teachers. TSS, and he was asking questions in English, and somebody had claimed we had an English answerer. So then he asked what was, he typed in 2 8-digit numbers and asked what the product of that was. And thinking fast, I typed out accumulator overflow. But he noticed that it was being typed one letter at a time.
It may be that there was not just one of these.
That could be. Do we have any questions from out here for any of our panelists?
Steve, tell me why would
Wasn't
the torpedoes in Space War never affected by gravity?
Because it took too much time to calculate gravity for the torpedoes. An example of an important principle of PDP-1 programming, which was the dominating principle of PDP-8 programming, and that is you compromise the problem until it fits on the machine you've got. That's the Dave Hall book, isn't it? Basic computer games?
Yeah.
I used the most sophisticated language available at the time I started, which was macro.
Space War was written in a language that you will find in this particular book. There are two separate listings of Space War, the original final version and a version that was developed at MIT over the ensuing summer months and that came out in September. But if you want to see what the kind of programming that we did, you're welcome to have a look at this afterwards. I'll open it to a few pages and you'll get some idea of what went through our mind.
I would like to point out with some unjustified pride that I was quizzed by the lawyers a year or so ago about what some of the, or not the lawyers, but one of the consultants they had on one of the patent cases on what Space War did, and I had commented it just barely well enough so that I could look at what was puzzling them and say, oh yes, that does, and explain it correctly. It's all his fault.
The guy with the yellow shirt,
he did it. He's the last guy to design the whole thing.
Who is the guy with the yellow shirt now?
Dan Murphy.
Now, all right, I'd be guilty. He was hooked up on the 3680
we've all been talking about on the second floor of Building 26.
And TECO, for the benefit of those who might not know, was... So we all owe search and replace in our word processors to that hack, is that it?
Well, in fact, I did most of my programming in the 60s in TECO, and I still have this little bit of code, which I think is the shortest description of the universal Turing machine ever written, that four little lines of TECO. But the last time I tried it, it didn't work. I wonder if you have a...
I wasn't going to say that out loud.
For those of you who don't know TECO, you should understand that those who do have some form of love-hate relationship with it. It is very powerful, and we've all used it to do something that we couldn't do any other way. But it's also powerfully mysterious when you start trying to do things that are complicated, and we've all been done in by it more times than we can remember.
It's good because it makes ATL look so simple.
By the way, I consider, I don't know what the ultimate TECO hack is, but I consider the macro written by Gosper that found the first glider gun by searching through every kind of configuration for the game of life. This was discovered by a TECO macro.
So,
No, I never did. Well, for many years, the DEC, TECO was an important CAD tool, too, so I couldn't have done the PDP-10 without it.
And vital to digital's engineering data processing, because Dick Best's list was maintained at TECO.
Oh, yes.
There's a question back there.
DEC debugging tape.
Debugging tape. All right. When DEC took over some of these things, they changed the key to mean other things. But it was very good, not right. Visual debugging tape and so forth. But it was originally tape for everything.
I guess we should also pay homage to another family of PDP-1 programs. We mentioned expensive typewriter. There was also expensive desk calculator and expensive planetarium. And at Stanford, when we had a PDP-1, we also briefly had expensive tape recorder and expensive mirror. The idea was these things did the functions that said, but they did them using $120,000 worth of equipment, which made them spectacularly more expensive than using the real item.
What did expensive mirror do?
It was a program that read the TV camera with excruciating slowness and displayed it on the CRT.
Okay.
All right.
Smart.
No, I don't think we paid attention to that.
Smart.
Yes, smart. Smart, meaning small matter of programming.
All right. Well, okay. There was there one more question out there? Okay. The Soroban Computyper. That reminds me, one of the things that we didn't mention about PDP-1, which I was noticing on the one over in the other building,
was that they all came with a piece of do-it-yourself I.O. in them. And so one of the things that you could do merely by purchasing a few extra modules was cause whatever you had in the room to get connected to the computer. And almost everybody used that for getting space war controls in. But it was also done for a lot of lab equipment. And nothing else beforehand. Nobody else had ever even thought of telling you how to connect, get your switches into the computer or whatever, or get your signals out. It was just you plugged it into the official printer, and that was all you needed to do.
Right. When the first production PDP-1 was delivered to BBN, had this kind of I.O. capability, and we knew we had this scheduled event, and Ken Olson was there and all kinds of important people, and there was this big red ribbon. We had a ribbon-cutting ceremony, except the computer did something that pulled a paper cutter down and it chopped its own ribbon.
Let me tell you, to me, the greatest thing about the PDP-1 was the fact that
When you had an idea, this was the first time in sort of the history of the world, and this idea involved either programming or hardware ideas like that, you could implement them in a few days. And all kinds of very important things that used to be projects that took forever, just a bunch of guys would go and make something happen that illustrated that it could be done, and they do it in, you know, by staying up a few nights in a row and get it done in a few days. It was just fantastic.
Yeah, I want to mention something else that perhaps I should have mentioned before. And that was the PDP-1 was a machine which had a 5-microsecond cycle. And yet it managed to use it was possible to build time-sharing systems on it that served a fair number of users. Better than many systems do today in terms of promptness. And
yes.
The swapping drum, of course, was the key to it, in that in one drum revolution, which was 30 milliseconds.
And no latency.
Without latency, that was another piece of Ed's elegance. It could swap one 4K user out and another 4K user in. And when we had it at Stanford, it could really give reasonable service on this very slow machine to 12 users. And I remember when we started the WAPS, low overhead time sharing at Stanford, which was in 75, and we used DEC 20. I had made calculations back in the early days which said that, sure, a PDP-1 ought to be able to handle quite a lot of users if all they're doing is editing, because here's how long it takes for an interrupt, and here's how long it takes to put the character in the buffer. And then the question arose, well, why is it that one DEC 20 is not enough to handle these students? Why is it so slow? And I put a guy working on it, and he found out that if you were using the ancient editor, it was written at Stanford a long time ago, then a typical editor user used 1/250th of the machine of this DEC 20, which was pretty bad from the point of view of what ought to have been possible, but was plenty good from the point of view of our requirements. However, if he was using Emacs, he was using 1/70th of the machine, which made him an average user. So that is, we were trying to serve 70 people on the machine. So one of the other consequences of this enormous increase in memory is that nobody knows today where the computer time is going.
Well, it goes into all running all that code that fits in all the extra memory.
Okay. All right.
Okay,
well, maybe we'll just take that one because we're getting a little short of time, and this will finish it off.
Great hackers here.
and we've got these machines with all this memory. So how many virtual PDP-1s are there? If you guys love using PDP-1s, there are colored scopes, there are black and white scopes, they're not vector scopes. But, you know, are there lots of emulators running around for this ultimate and great machine?
No, I don't think anyone claimed it was ultimately great for now.
It seemed great at the time.
For that. And many of the things were, well, it was a paper tape machine. And at Stanford, the first time-sharing system we built there, we faithfully simulated paper tape on the drum. And then tried
to make the drum go backwards.
Yeah, well, we then tried to teach undergraduates. We then tried to use it for some undergraduate courses and discovered that paper tape was pretty hard to explain, pretty cumbersome to explain. It was a 46-step process to get your program assembled when you wrote it all down. And when you faithfully simulated it, the fact that you didn't have physical tape didn't make it a bit easier to understand at all. It was really nice to have it really is nice to have a proper file system.
Okay, on that note, I think let's thank our panel and our guests for a terrific afternoon. And thank the PDP-1 for kicking off the year of interactive computing.